calling case 84605 in re Parental Rights. Counsel, you state your appearance, please.
Nina Barra Gritsby, bar number 10308, appearing for the appellant.
Ms. Richter, you here for the respondent?
Yes, ma'am.
All right, is everybody ready to proceed?
Yes, sir.
All right. Ms. Grigsby, did you want to reserve any time for rebuttal?
Yes, if I could have 5 minutes.
All right, excellent. When you're ready.
This case came in when the father was driving with the children and he was pulled over for drunk driving. Mom was hospitalized and unable to take placement of the children. So it wasn't anything that mom did. She was unable to take custody of the children as she was hospitalized. There was a petition filed, which she pled to. She was given a case plan, which required her to do substance abuse, maintain contact with DFS, and have appropriate housing and resources. There was no requirement for her to engage in domestic violence treatment. Case plan was amended a few months later. Still, there was nothing added that required her to engage in domestic violence treatment. She did start engaging. She started engaging right away, but she wasn't able to maintain her services. But in July of 2021, she got involved in drug court and domestic violence treatment, which she wasn't required. She took her own initiative to start engaging in those services. And at the last day of trial, she had been 7 months clean. She had completed 12 out of the 16 domestic violence classes. That all the testimony during trial was that she was consistent with visitation with the children. She was appropriate. There were never any concerns with the way that her visits went with the children. There were never.
Ms. Grigsby?
Yes.
Sorry. Go ahead, Justice Bell.
Had she completed her case plan at the time of trial?
She hadn't fully completed, as she still had a few more months of drug counseling left. But at that time, she had been 7 months clean.
And then I was going to ask about, some of the reasoning of the district judge in making her ruling ultimately terminating your client's parental rights relates to the history. In other words, there were multiple prior issues with the children where the children were taken away and then she would do better and she would get the children back, and then it happened multiple times. And so it seems like that caused the district court some concern about, even though she was complying at the time of the trial, about whether that would continue once the trial finished and she got the children back. Can you address that?
Yes. She did previously have cases, and unfortunately I wasn't her attorney in those cases, so I don't know if it was the exact same issues or if there were different issues that had resulted in the removal of the children. Drugs were an issue for her, and part of treatment and recovery is relapse. And this is something that is going to be a lifelong thing. But at that time, she had shown, and she, during her testimony, she did discuss how this drug treatment was different than what she had previously done. She had more resources through the drug court. She had a relapse prevention plan. She had a support group. And drug court is a year-long program, so she had never engaged in treatment for that substantial amount of time. She had done outpatient treatment going in. Believe she tried rescue, she tried bridge counseling, but she was able to testify that the reason this time it's different is because of all the additional resources that have come with the drug court. And one of the factors that the court looked at in terminating her parental rights was that a finding under 432B393 was made that reasonable efforts weren't required. And that's one of the issues I had raised, is that in 128, that part of the statute should be considered unconstitutional, as it requires a different standard under 432B, and termination of parental rights require clear and convincing evidence.
But I have a question on that, because the provision on 432B-393 that led the court to relieve DFS of the obligation to pursue reunification was subparagraph D, which provides as the basis for that relief that the child or a sibling of the child was previously removed from the home, adjudicated to have been abused or neglected, returned to the home, and subsequently removed from the home as a result of abuse or neglect. I understand your argument about the standard of proof, but when I look at that, this is the grounds that's in play in this, and this is the grounds that the district court relied on. That is a matter of record proof in documents that were before the district court, that this child and a sibling of this child had been removed, returned, re-removed. So there really isn't a differentiating burden of proof in play in this case. Could you comment on that?
Yes. So any findings that are made under 432B are made by preponderance of the evidence. And when you're looking at terminating parental rights, it's looking at where is the parent.
You're missing the question. This subparagraph is a matter of record, whether or not those children were removed, then returned, then removed again. That's a matter of record in the court, that those removals, returns, and re-removal, that's something that's knowable absolutely, isn't it?
That's correct.
And you concede, do you not, that in fact that occurred here, that this child and a sibling were removed, re-removed, returned, and then re-removed?
And usually that's a basis for waiving reasonable efforts, requiring that DFS doesn't have to make efforts to reunify. But when you look at termination of parental rights, that's not a factor that's considered in terminating parental rights. The factors that are looked at are based on where is the parent at the time of the termination of parental rights trial,
but if we know that the children were removed, returned, and removed again, then whether, if it was only found by a preponderance, is it not harmless error, if error at all, because it would be shown by clear and convincing evidence, because we know in fact that that happened?
And I agree that that's true, but that's not a basis for terminating parental rights, because that happens where, in cases where, you know, kids are removed, returned, they come back in, but at that time, parents are able to make changes, they're able to reunify. So when you get to a TPR trial and the judge isn't, the way the statute's written, that finding is enough to terminate. Judge,
so
are you saying
that the waiver of the reunification efforts cannot be used as a parental fault basis? And if that's what you're arguing, then what's the authority for that?
I'm arguing that they're denied due process, as the what's being looked at the termination trial is not what they've done to rectify leading to the children coming in. It's based on what happened previously and not where the parent is at on the day of the trial. So I think that can be taken into consideration, that have things changed, but once that finding is made, there's no discretion. As the way statute's written, it states if the finding is made, then they can move right on to best interests and not have to look at any other parental fault grounds. They can't look at, is this parent in a better position today, is that which my client was. She was in a position where she had stayed consistently clean.
But what do we do with the district court's finding on page 541 of the record that the court states, the court did not find the mother's testimony credible when she said she is now done with the father, and that's in the context. It follows by a couple of sentences the court's concern about the recycling on drug abuse and the children coming in and out of the home. To me, and I looked at the record in this case, and we don't have the volume one in the appendix. We don't have the full day's testimony. So we don't have the current foster parent, whose name escapes me, who testified, and we don't have one of the state workers who testified, because that's not part of our record on appeal, which makes it very hard, apart from the constitutional issue, to find that the district court's finding was not supported by substantial evidence as to some of these other factors.
I apologize. I thought all of the testimony was submitted as the in the appendix.
It's in volume one that I don't find what should be in there.
I believe volume four is where the testimony. Volume three and four contain all the transcripts from the trial.
Where is the foster parent's testimony? And you can find that when you sit down and come back up and tell me.
Okay, I can.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Good afternoon, Your Honor. Stephanie Richter, bar number 12075 for the respondent. Under NRS 128, the state has to show two things for terminating parental rights. The first being that there was a basis for a waiver of reasonable efforts under NRS 432B.393 or a parental fault ground as enumerated in the statute, as well as best interests. In looking at best interests, the court does take into consideration under the statutory factors enumerated there where the parents are today. In this case, the court found that there was both a waiver of reasonable efforts that was granted, as well as multiple parental fault grounds. So even if this court were to find that the court should not have used the waiver and takes that from the testimony, there was multiple parental fault grounds that were supported.
Do you think that there was substantial evidence to support those parental fault grounds? Because I'm just looking at the record, and some of the analysis done by the district court doesn't seem to fit necessarily squarely with the factors. And so do we have a substantial evidence issue here?
I do think the court found substantial evidence. The court considered the prior history. There was a 2013 removal for substance abuse and domestic violence issues, a 2016 removal for substance abuse and domestic violence issues, and the court did not find the mother's testimony to be credible. The court did acknowledge...
Well, as to her relationship with the father,
as
right?
to her relationship with the
overall,
father.
But not overall, she didn't find her. And she's been testing negative for her... So she's been testing consistently negative for drugs?
So her last positive drug test was in July of 2021, and the court did not find her credible as to the explanation for why she tested positive, in addition to her relationship with the father. And then at trial in November of 2021, she had been clean for that period of time. The court also considered that she had previously engaged in family treatment court at the beginning of the case in 2020 and did not complete it. And that she testified that she'd done prior drug treatment twice through bridge counseling, and that she had a substance abuse history dating back to the age of 18. And so the court had concerns as to whether there was going to be lasting behavioral change. And then there was the testimony that she was going to be in treatment for at least another 6 months. And the court considered the fact that at that point we were approximately 21 months since the children had been removed when she reached her decision.
So, Ms. Richter, it really seems from the record, though, like the district court stopped looking at anything that happened after the point where reasonable efforts were waived
Doesn't the district court have to look at the whole picture at the time of the trial?
Well, the court, I believe, did look at the whole picture. She cited in her decision that the efforts that the mother had made most recently in drug court. She cited to the domestic violence classes that the mother had done, and then she found that the mother still was engaging with the father, that they'd had an incident in June of 2021, that they worked at the same place and that they were continuing to maintain contact at the time of the TPR trial that the mother testified to. So
the court made a finding that reunification couldn't happen in the foreseeable future, and I didn't understand what that was based on. I mean, certainly wouldn't be participation in the drug court, right?
Correct. I believe the court was looking at the continued domestic violence with the father and the continued interaction with the father, and that she did not feel that she would be able to predict when reunification would be able to occur.
Well, was there any evidence that they were residing together at the time, because he had been taken off the lease?
The department had concerns because the mother testified that the father had been taken off the lease on October of 2021, right before the termination of parental rights trial, because he believed that if he took his name off the lease, she would be more likely to get the children back. And that's what the mother testified to. Not that she asked him to take his name off the lease, but that they did it to show the court.
Can you point to her testimony to that effect in the record?
I'd have to look at the exact page number.
Okay.
But, and when we look at the findings made in this case, particularly with regards to the waiver was based on the prior removal, the return, and the removal. And those are facts that exist in the record that was before the district court, as well as the mother's own testimony at the time of the TPR trial that her children had previously been removed for concerns in 2013 and concerns in 2016.
So if a parent was in that situation, is there anything that they can do to rebut the presumption that parental rights should be terminated?
They can put forth evidence that they've changed their circumstances at trial, and regardless of the waiver, and that would go to best interest. If they've remedied their circumstances, it would not be in the children's best interest to terminate parental rights. If you look at the factors under 128.107, 108, and 109, those factors would weigh in favor of keeping parental rights intact if the parents have made behavioral change at that point and have remedied their circumstances such that they'd be able to reunify.
So well, I guess that's where I'm struggling with this a little bit. Isn't that exactly what she did? She was clean. She was working. She had housing. So I guess that's where I'm just kind of at a loss.
So the court found that she had done it at the 11th hour in compliance-based, not behavioral change, that she had not begun to engage in anything until after the termination of parental rights was filed. She testified that she went back to family treatment court and informed them that she was there because her rights were at risk of being terminated. The court determined that they had concerns that she was still engaging in contact with the father, and so the court wasn't seeing, based on the findings, that she had made the behavioral change that she was testifying to. They didn't find... The court made several findings that her testimony was not credible regarding the changes that she made.
Was part of her case plan that she not be with the father or that she not have a relationship with the children's father?
Specifically, part of her case plan, in the goals as they were written, was that she was managing her substance abuse and no longer involves herself in a violent relationship.
Okay, and so she tested negative regularly prior to the trial and at the time of trial. She maintained stable housing for almost a year and provided proof of monthly income for a period of months. She also, on her own, initiated domestic violent treatment, and her testimony was that she's no longer with Jeffrey, whether the court, and I don't second-guess the court's determination on credibility, but these are the things that show up in the record in terms of what she was doing, and it sounds like she was doing everything right. Are you saying because her motivation for doing these things to get her kids back is improper, therefore?
I'm saying the court's looking at a pattern here of prior removals, returns, removals again, as well as the fact that there was a TPO in the summer of 2021. She testified that the father had, they'd engaged in domestic violence, and the father had tried to run her over with a car in June of 2021, that there had been...
How does that make her an unfit parent? I mean, if the husband is committing domestic violence on her. How does that show neglect, unfitness, or any of the other factors that the court looked at?
Because she's failing to protect the children from being exposed to domestic violence by continuing her relationship with them. In prior cases, the children were exposed to domestic violence because of the parent, because of her involvement with the father. They had both been perpetrators in previous cases. The children had been exposed to it, and they were in therapy at the time of the TPR. That's in testimony from the foster parent. They were in therapy at the time of the TPR because of what they had been exposed to, and they were exhibiting behaviors of aggression as a result of what they had seen.
When you said earlier that even if there is an issue with the waiver of reasonable efforts parental fault ground, there are all these other grounds upon which the court found parental fault. Let's assume for the moment that we have a problem with all of the other grounds of parental fault, either in an evidentiary issue or the court's analysis issue. If all that's left is the waiver of reasonable efforts, how do you defend that with the burden of proof issue?
The fact of the matter is that those facts exist. Even if the court at the time of the TPR made findings that that order had been entered, those findings were made by clear and convincing evidence. There's findings from below of facts that exist, regardless of the standard of proof. It's in the record that the children were removed, and returned. And the mother herself testified to that at the TPR trial, putting those facts
so
in evidence.
Would you concede that traditionally, not with specificity on this case, but traditionally, waiver of reasonable efforts can be based upon a preponderance of the evidence standard, but your argument is that here it's been proven without a doubt that that occurred?
Correct. Oftentimes it is based on a preponderance standard. Our office oftentimes asks for those standards by clear and convincing evidence. That was not done in this case for,
right.
I was not the attorney at the time.
Words here.
Correct. I was not the attorney at the time, and the remedy for this would be to put a standard into the statute to say what the finding on a waiver should be, whether it's clear and convincing evidence or not. 432B.393 seems to be the remedy to that, but the legislature did not choose to do that.
Could the waiver alone? I'm sorry. Could the waiver alone be enough to terminate parental rights?
You'd also have to have the best interest findings, but I believe the statute is clear that it's an or, mm-hmm. Not an and. So either a waiver or a parental fault ground.
But in this, is this case a good case to take the issue of the standard of proof in the 432B statute, where under this particular provision, subparagraph D, it's a matter of record fact that the removal return
I do not believe that this would be the appropriate case. I believe that there are other grounds on there under 393 that would be more appropriate, that are more discretionary, and allow for a more discretionary finding by the district court. But this, in this case, it's a matter of record that this occurred.
And you're saying that the mother's own testimony admits that sequence occurred.
Correct. She testified at TPR that had occurred.
But I have a follow-up question. That's judging. The statute's making the judgment that this pattern is something that we're not going to keep trying to reunify this family, and the court can order that DFS is relieved from that. But that is a rearview mirror kind of a perspective. So I think the point in this case is, well, time passed, and she had, by her testimony, been working hard to improve the situation. So where does the current behavior become a factor in assessing the child's best interest prong?
Correct. I believe that belongs in the best interest prong. Where this statute comes from is the Adoption and Safe Families Act, that the federal law requires be in place. And there,
is subparagraph D out of that act?
It is not. It is something that the Nevada legislature added, okay, in addition to that act.
Thank you.
Where are the children now?
Children, three of them remain in the same foster home. One has been placed into a separate foster home after displaying sexualized behaviors in that home and having a case with the delinquency system. He is in family therapy with his and regularly visits with his siblings, but the other three remain in the same adoptive home as from the time of trial.
Have they expressed any preference as to where they want to be?
They expressed a preference by joining the brief of the respondent in this case, mm-hmm, that they wish to remain where they are at this time.
Okay.
And I have a
question. There's been some argument made about the fact that when the children were removed initially leading to this case, that the mom, the appellant here, that she was in the hospital and like not at the home, wasn't involved in the incident that led to the children being taken by the state at that time. How, if at all, does that impact what happens in this case?
Well, she ultimately pled no contest to the initial 432B petition, which then results in a case plan, which she needs to comply with under the guidelines within a year to avoid the case moving to termination of parental rights. The concerns regarding her at time of removal were not just that she was in the hospital, but as well as the fact that she had drug use issues and the family lacked resources. So the children could not be reunified with her as she did not have a home.
And I guess what I'm getting when I read the court's order is that while she appears to have made progress and was, you know, clean for some period of time and doing the things we would want to see her doing, it seems that the court was concerned that she previously had done so, had gotten the kids back, and then found herself back in the system. Is that kind of what leads us to be where we are today?
Correct.
That's the idea. Was Correct. That the argument that DFS was making?
The argument that DFS made was that her behavior change was compliance-based and that any behavior change was compliance-based and that they had not seen behavior change regarding
domestic violence.
Can you explain
what you mean by that?
So the department assesses a parent based on where they are on stages of change. And they're looking for a parent to be in a particular stage of change and demonstrate behavior change by their actions and their statements. And when they say it's compliance-based, they mean that they're just attempting to check the boxes on the case plan to be able to get the children back, but they're not seeing that the parent has internalized what they've needed to learn to have it not occur in the future.
But didn't her therapist testify contrary to that?
Her therapist testified that she was doing well in treatment at the time, yes.
Right, and the therapist also testified that she did not believe that the behavior change was compliance-based.
Correct.
Okay.
Great. Thank you.
And I apologize, I couldn't find the exact page number for the testimony, but it's volume 3 where the testimony where the state's witnesses testified is contained, and the placement was the state's witness. But just to go off of what Mr. Richter was saying regarding the therapist's testimony, and with drugs, you can't really say that it's going through the motions. Being drug-free requires you to internalize it. That's something that the parent has to be able to overcome to not use. That's something that it's
How many chances should she be given? Because as counsel was explaining, she had been given this chance before. She was reunified with the kids. They took them back away because she relapsed into the same situation. So how many times do we have to, how many chances do we have to give?
I don't think it's a matter of giving a number. It's a matter of seeing where the parent has done it, where in this case she was 7 months into, actually 8 months into treatment, but 7 months of being clean. And she has shown like a consistent pattern of being able to stay clean and being able to verbalize what her triggers are, how she's maintaining her sobriety. And in this case, she's done that. And I know we can't talk about what wasn't presented, but she went on to complete drug court and she's continued to stay clean as DFS did recently drug test her and she came back clean. So we're looking at someone, yes, it took her a long time. Should it have taken that long? No, but she made those changes and she's continued to show that she's willing to make those changes in her life, not just to get the kids back, but to be able to do that for herself. And it took a long time. I'm not saying that that was justified, but by the time of the trial, she had shown that 7 months she had stayed clean. And her therapist, I think that was the strongest testimony. It wasn't just coming from her, but from the professional who's working with her to be able to testify on her behalf that this isn't just checking the boxes. This is something that she's working through in therapy. She's able to verbalize, and she's able to show by testing clean that she has kicked that habit. And looking
at did she testify that the only reason she took Jeffrey off the lease was to increase her chances of getting the kids back? I couldn't find that testimony.
I do not recall her saying that. She talked about what she's learned in domestic violence classes. She talked about the pattern of behavior. She talked about how she doesn't want to be around that, and that relationship has not gone back to that relationship. So
is she seeing the kids in the interim right now while this appeal is pending?
She is not.
And what about counselor's representations that the children do not want to be reunified with mom?
That I do not know, because there are four children. One child is not with the siblings. One child is separated. So I'm not sure how that child and the other three could all have the same preference when they're not together, and that's a sibling group, and there's a presumption that the siblings should stay together. And the children were young, so I'm not sure, and they didn't testify at trial, so I'm not sure what their testimony would be, but in everyone who testified, the department and mom, they all talked about how great the visits went, how appropriate she was, how there was no concern regarding her contact with the children.
Thank you, Ms. Grigsby. This matter will stand submitted, and we will just be